Adam.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a somber ceremony this morning, New York recovery and cleanup crews marked the official end of their work at Ground Zero. They rang a bell, heard the skirl of bagpipes, and left the site. Done. But for many New Yorkers, the path to closure remains difficult. The trauma of 9/11 remains as deep and wide as the now tidy 16-acre pit in Lower Manhattan. New studies coming out speak to the psychological trauma suffered by New Yorkers in the wake of September 11th. Reports find that alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana use rose, and as many as 400,000 New Yorkers suffered post-traumatic stress disorder or clinical depression following the attacks. I spoke earlier with Ian Miller. He's a psychotherapist in New York City and a volunteer counselor with the Red Cross. I asked him how New Yorkers saw and understood the ceremonial conclusion today of the World Trade Center cleanup.
Most of the New Yorkers I know are aware of it, but have very little feeling about it as a conclusion. I think it's significant that it was such a short ceremony and that it headed uptown very briefly. I think it is a closure of a kind, but it's not a closure psychologically.
We spoke with you in December about the trauma that New Yorkers had suffered, about what you had seen as a Red Cross volunteer at Ground Zero and as a clinical psychologist. Describe the arc to us, if you can, in terms of the whole city or individuals within it, of dealing with, coming to terms with, you put the right words on it, how are New Yorkers handling the continuing unfolding of this memory, this impact?
I think we've done what Mayor Giuliani asked us to do. We've gotten on with our lives. The difficulty with that is that there are large pockets in our lives now of great anxiety. Reminded of it last weekend when the New York Times magazine had an article about nuclear terrorism.
Yeah.
And I asked four or five friends if they'd read it, and nobody had because they were so frightened. Of course, it's during a period when we're also being inundated with information from the federal government about threats to us.
And many of those purportedly aimed at New York.
Yes.
Break that down for us. There are big pockets that remain, you say. Part of that has to do with present and future fear of an additional attack. Are there still pockets unresolved of simply of the echo and impact of 9/11?
Oh, certainly.
And how do you understand those as a psychologist? Well, it's one thing for the mayor to say, let's get on with our lives, but where do people put those images? Where do they put the adrenaline and terror of that day in their psyches?
It begins to reshape one's life, one's responses. For example, if you're afraid to go in the subway, you start living without a subway system in your mind. You start living on the surface. In the minds of children, there are kids who are, well, there was a report that came out, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago, that at least 15% of the children in New York City public schools are suffering symptoms of PTSD.
That is post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes, and that was done, I think, in the late winter. What happens is people reshape their lives in avoidance of thinking about anything having to do with a massive trauma.
We read reports that Manhattan residents have drunk more alcohol, smoked more tobacco, and smoked more marijuana since September 11th.
That was in the report that I read was that those things were going on in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, and it's probably true. I don't know if it's continued.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that people are very, very edgy. There's a lot more talk of doom. In the general population,
mm-hmm.
In my practice, I've only recently begun to see people who have been traumatized earlier in their lives begin to talk about the effects of September 11th. People who had spoken about it shortly after the events, it's beginning to seep in. I'm beginning to get detail that I hadn't gotten 6 months ago.
So they had earlier traumas in their life that are now associated with 9/11 or kept in the same closet?
Yes, yes. 9/11 has evoked them, and 9/11 is only now becoming expressed. That is, I mean, the incubation period has been half a year.
Mm-hmm.
I know the speaking to people in the fire department in New York, and folks there in the counseling service are bracing for an onslaught of referrals as they've closed down the site, as the formal activity of recovery comes to a close.
We've seen the faces of those men and women, mainly men, who week after week took out the grim remains of everything there. What's your take on them from a distance at this point, I guess? But they seemed so wrapped up almost in a sacramental way in that removal. Is this like coming home from war?
I think in many ways it's probably far worse. Many people don't experience the level of trauma that these guys have experienced in war. Additionally, their families have been affected in ways that they hadn't been affected before, despite the dangers of the job. In the past, the uniformed services were able to shield their families from the level of danger at work. And now everyone's been affected by it. The coverage, the media coverage, has been so extensive that in terms of their private lives, the boundary between private life and work life, that's broken down. And it's going to change their work. It's going to change the way they are at work.
What's your advice to individuals, or what's the thinking in the psychology community about, as you say, people compartmentalizing in a way, holding this fear apart from the getting on with everyday life? The mantra of the therapy world is, you know, talk it out, deal with it, come to terms with it, don't be afraid of it, don't lock it up. Can a trauma the size of 9/11 be treated that way?
Yes. It's not simple. In fact, what has to be done, essentially, is a reliving of it therapeutically, a going through it, and a reformation of meaning that's been broken apart, a reassessment of where one is based on what's happened, and a kind of reentry into what the world looks like now based on what that experience has done to you.
And do you see many New Yorkers who are successfully doing that or who are not successfully doing that?
I'm sort of biased in that I conduct psychotherapy for a living. So, yes, and I do see New Yorkers who are doing it. I also think in the general population, it's a very tall order. It's a very hard thing to do, to look at something that you don't want to look at and to actively grapple with it and make sense of it. It's the last thing you want to do.
Do New Yorkers talk about September 11th among themselves with friends, or is it a taboo? Do you only do it after, you know, three beers and a chaser?
I think everybody talks about it all the time.
Mm.
It's an impossible thing to avoid. I mean, when one speaks about how's the last year been or something like that,
mm-hmm.
it always refers back to September. You know, when we talk about last summer, there's a sigh, and the memory that was right before September 11th. It's a huge marker, and it hasn't gone away. And I don't believe it's going to go away as a function of a ceremony at Ground Zero. Everybody is hyper aware of danger, and it's odd that one of the things that happens in post-traumatic stress is that vigilance gets heightened. And at the same time, attention diminishes. It gets kind of fuzzy.
Attention to what?
To the environment. while you're on high alert, it becomes unclear what you're on alert for.
So you step in front of the bus because you're in a daze, or?
No, it's not quite a daze, but it's an uncertainty, a slight lack of focus about what's going on, but attention. So what I'm getting at is that the warnings from the federal government and from from everywhere, it seems at this point, heighten the level of anxiety, but don't do anything to sharpen a sense of where one should be focused. So I think it exacerbates it. It heightens the tendency to want to dissociate.
The iconic profile of the New Yorker is sassy, brassy, in your face. is that still New York?
There are some of us who are probably still like that. It's characterological, but I think we're a chastened bunch. This is scary business.
Ian Miller is a psychotherapist in New York City and a volunteer with the Red Cross. He spoke with us earlier today. Over the past 8 months, countless workers and volunteers have labored shoulder to shoulder in the monumental task of cleaning up and recovering the vast wreckage that was once the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and the 2,823 men and women who died there. Now the truckloads of destruction and remains have been removed, the mangled steel beams dismantled. The work of recovery at the site is, astonishingly, officially over. The months-long cleanup of the World Trade Center site was a kind of American sacrament. Now it's over, but how to move on from tragedy to new life? What does Ground Zero mean to you? Are you ready for the cleanup to be finished? Are you ready to rebuild? And how will you remember that great and awful heap of rubble, grief, and heroism? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York City is Joel Meyerowitz. He's a photographer and filmmaker and is creating a photographic archive of the World Trade Center disaster and response. Good evening and welcome back, Joel Meyerowitz.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks. And from Providence, Rhode Island, our on-point news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon. Lewis Gordon is director of Africana Studies at Brown University and a native New Yorker. Hello and good evening, Lewis Gordon.
Oh, good evening, Tom.
Joel Meyerowitz, we talked in December when you were up to your hips in photographing everything that was going on then. Were you at the ceremony today that marked the official end of recovery?
I was right there at the top of the ramp when the enormous body, the 62-ton body of steel draped in black, came up the ramp.
This was the last beam, the only significant beam that had remained standing after the collapse of the towers.
It's, funny, down there they call it the stick, the last stick. It's funny how workers' terminology diminishes something in a way.
Maybe it has to diminish it in order to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's their lingo, I think. And they've seen so much. I mean, they've removed so many other sticks and rubble. In fact, the whole place was like a giant pickup sticks. You know, that's how they took it apart. The iron workers did the heavy lifting and literally moved it stick by stick out of there until they came to the last one. And it was incredibly poignant. The other night, when they cut it down and they lowered it onto this truck, everything about that ceremony was the summation of all of the effort of the 8.5 months. They brought in a virgin truck, never used before for any loads, and it was painted black, and they had black beams on it to rest the big beam, and they had black shrouding. I mean, everything was done with such incredible attention to the details for the feeling of sacrament, I think.
Sacrament all over this. Joel Meyerowitz, hang on, we have to take a short break.
Yeah.
But we're stuck with that image already of a virgin truck painted black, and the sacrament that the World Trade Center site came to represent, and the removal and recovery and cleanup came to represent after the shock, the humbling. What did Ground Zero mean to you? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about living with, living through, living after Ground Zero. Our guest is Joel Meyerowitz. He's an internationally known photographer and filmmaker. He's creating a photographic archive of the World Trade Center disaster and response. And our guest news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon of Brown University. You can join the conversation as well. Are you relieved that the cleanup is done? Or is the evidence of national pain somehow gone too fast? How do we move on without forgetting? And what was, what is the symbolism of that pit in Lower Manhattan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joel Meyerowitz, you were there from early days after 9/11. You got your camera in and photographed all the way through. We last spoke with you in December when the cleanup was still in the truly gruesome and grueling period. You describe it tonight already in these sacramental terms. And as you look back on all the intimate moments and this conclusion, at least ceremonial conclusion today, was this a kind of American sacrament unfolding?
I think so. I think for the first time we had an event that really brought us all together rather than in some sportive way, you know, rooting for some team. We were challenged as a nation for the first time on our own soil, and I think it changed everybody's sense of respect for each other and for the work being done down there and for those firemen and the souls that were lost. And at least in the pit, I can tell you that there was a heightened sense of spirituality and of devotion to the task, a comradeship that I have never experienced, and I've only read about when you hear about people in a war bonding together in some way and never forgetting that they experienced that together. And that was the tone of the workers' lives down in Ground Zero, from grand gestures to from removing things to the humblest gestures of the firemen raking the last bit of pebbles as recently as yesterday.
Joel, give us a sense of the tempo, how the labor went. Because on the one hand, we're told that people went through this with a fine-tooth comb, that there was tenderness and this kind of almost sacred mood about everything that was done there. On the other hand, this site was cleaned up way faster than anyone ever expected. So there was a lot of vigorous work going on as well. What was that balance between, you know, sacramental care and speed?
Well, I'll tell you what I heard just 2 days ago. I've become friendly with the head supervisor of the whole cleanup operation down there for the Bovis Construction Company. And he said, you know, if we didn't have to do the recovery portion of this, the search and recovery, we could.
That means for human remains.
For human remains. He said, we didn't have to slow down for this. Mm-hmm. We could have cleaned out the site in a month. I said, Come on, you can't do it in a month. He said, no, we already had two of those enormous excavators that work in quarries that pick up, 100 tons at a time. He said, we had them picked out, and they were going to be disassembled and brought into New York on 100 trucks each. He said, and we were going to take this site apart. You know, and we had planned in a month, and here it was, let's say, 9 months. So the dusting and scraping and raking and sifting gave us, you might say, an 8 month lengthening of this process.
Wow, months in which they could take that care. Lewis Gordon, we see the workers come out of the pit, out of the work site, and there is this sense that somehow these are, or were, temple acolytes, that they went to some kind of altar of disaster for this country.
Indeed, the excavation itself almost had an archaeological feature to it. The workers' terminology makes much sense to me. In the midst of such carnage, it makes sense to fight against despair. And part of fighting against despair is to not take oneself seriously, but take the work seriously, which is ironic, since this is about a homage to the lives of, you know, the people who were lost. I remember shortly after the towers fell, I had to attend a meeting abroad, and it was on September 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the unions who were to attend this meeting pulled out for the mere fact that they had to deal with too many funerals. So this gives you the whole workers' dimension of this. The very fact that this was happening already showed us that the more crass, simple-minded political formulations of what happened would not work. There are new rules being played here. In fact, a lot of the old rules were broken. And I recall as our plane took off, I flew from LaGuardia. The plane went in the air and circled the island. And, you know, in terms of myself, from New York, I refused to go down there. And it was not out of any principled reason. It was just simply because it was too difficult.
Too much.
Too much. And I remember when the plane took off, the entire plane was silent. And as it circled Manhattan Island, we saw the pit with the smoke coming out of it like a volcano, like an evil volcano full of sacrifice. And you notice the language we use. All of these really come to the fact that we're dealing with a level of irreplaceability of a primordial character. These are people who will never walk the earth again, and many of us are able at that moment to connect with them. And I found not only was the plane connecting with the island, but there was this sense of collective, not only collective suffering, but collective understanding.
Even thousands of feet above it, we're talking about living through, living with, living after Ground Zero with Lewis Gordon and Joel Meyerowitz, photographer in New York. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. After the shock, after the humbling, what did Ground Zero mean to you? Robin is on the line. Welcome, Robin. You're on the air.
Thanks. I lost my mother September 11th at the Trade Center. And
sorry.
It really has changed my life. It seems like such a loss of innocence, as well as just the loss of all the potential ways that we could have been involved together for the rest of her life and my life.
Did you pay attention to the ceremony today, Robin? Did it mean anything, something to you?
It didn't mean so much to me. It really meant a lot to other people I know who lost people September 11th. But for me, and due to where my mother worked in the Trade Center, mm-hmm. they're never going to find anything.
What floor was she on, Robin?
She worked on like the 97th floor, the first tower that was hit.
How old was she last September?
She was 60 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she was full of life, and she loved the job that she did. And
what was her name?
Her name was Roberta Bernstein Heber, and she worked for Marsh McLennan.
Robin, when you see what is now quite a clean, tidy pit, what do you think? What should be done here? What resonates with you? Does it even matter? Does the physical site matter to you a little or a lot?
It definitely does matter to me some. I think part of it should definitely be used as a memorial site that people can go to. I went for the first time this past weekend, and I didn't want to go down, honestly, until it was cleaned up, because looking at all the rubble and the devastation, all I could think before was my mother could be under there, or some part of my mother. And now I know she's not there, and they're not going to find her, and so it was easier to go down.
Robin, thank you for calling, and we our thoughts are with you and your family and your mother even now. Thanks for calling tonight.
Yeah, sure.
Joel, the site in its terrible quality, it seemed in a way that almost made it a temple at the beginning. It was the images, and you must have captured a lot of them, of all that gnarled steel and that mountain of rubble. It seemed the only thing in the world that was equal to our confusion and grief and rage.
Well, it was awesome. It was almost incomprehensible to see the insides of those buildings turned out that way and exposed. Some secret was now out there, and the secret was our vulnerability and how easily we fall. And it was hard to absorb it for quite a long time, and even as it was being diminished, you know, it seemed like as they were taking it away, still more was revealed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hidden qualities further down, and with every layer taken away, there were more stories of discoveries and tragic mm-hmm. ends to people. And it was powerful all the way. And even when it was an empty pit in the last stages of the last month or two, down inside there was a kind of power and serenity. It's a funny combination, but the excavation itself was as big as the pyramids in some way. The man hours spent, the material moved, and the space itself. And to see New York peeking up over the edge when you were down in there left you in a funny, ambiguous place of a mixture of the awesome aftermath as well as a strange kind of beauty. And this is, I think, perplexing for a lot of people because you can't keep the image of the disaster alive when nature, in its indifference, shows you exquisite light or foggy days or rain or snowstorms. I mean, things are transforming it all the time. And so the pile and the pit, as they were undergoing this transformation, were also evolving into this next phase. And the 9 months is a gestation, if you think about it this way. And we've come out of this now. That pit was broom clean today. That's how they wanted it.
But Joel, I almost wonder if the speed of the cleanup wasn't faster than the speed of the national healing. In a way, it almost seems as though the sign, the wound, the rubble has gone away before we've been able to process it. It was almost a visual aid to comprehending what had happened, and now it's gone.
Well, I think that's true for a couple of reasons. One is so many people were really not allowed to see what it was like inside. I have to say it was a privilege to be down in there. It transformed itself to that. But since New Yorkers in particular were kept away from it, it became this forbidden city. Mm-hmm. And people, as they're isolated, don't have something to relate to. I mean, the disaster is something in your mind. And I could see the change in the attitudes of New Yorkers. They were beginning to move back into their life kind of quickly, 2-3 months afterwards. And although everybody's jumpy when you hear an explosion of a manhole cover or something mm-hmm. like that in New York, there was this sense of, life was coming back to them faster. And I was fearful that the national consciousness would change quickly also. We were so vulnerable, and I mean that in an emotional way, after the event, mm-hmm. and there was a kind of goodness in the country. I had such hope for us as a nation who might find its spirituality together in some union.
Don't tell us that's lost. Are you saying it's gone, Joel?
Well, I feel like there's been a lot of slippage, really. When I go into the pit and I'm with the workers and I come out and people are going about their lives, I don't think it's talked about all the time. The country knew that it's being cleaned up and being mm-hmm. repaired. The wound is being healed. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a passage that's occurred. And maybe there's great relief right now. Certainly the ceremony today with the bagpipes and the dirge and all of that was incredibly cathartic. I was in tears. I was really in tears for most of it today. I can tell you that. I just spontaneously cried.
Let's take a call. Kyla's on the line. Welcome, Kyla. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm a native New Yorker, born and raised, and I had just left, September 8th, I think, for graduate school here in Cambridge mm-hmm. and went back shortly thereafter. And I tell you that being someone who's derived a huge part of her identity from being a New Yorker and
from
not
the city.
Right, I am right. There's only one, the city in the world. But not having been there on that day has sort of set me apart from, my countrymen to some mm-hmm. level. The fact that there was this huge, literally gaping wound in our city, and I felt like I wasn't there to attend to it. And I think that so much of what it is to be a New Yorker at this point is very much bound up in where were you on that day? Did you see it? Did you have to walk home? Doesn't matter what walk of life you come from, how poor you mm-hmm. are, how rich you are. It really was so tremendously impactful. And I think that being in Boston, but everyone here was freaked out that the plane came from Boston, but the kind of experience of that grief, of the shock, of the not knowing what to do was so different.
It's a different thing at arm's length. Yeah. Kyla, when you go back, do you feel that New Yorkers have changed?
Totally. And it's little things. Like, I'll go down to the train, and another train route has changed, and I don't know my way around the city anymore because so many things have shifted to accommodate this disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And those things, I think, are unsettling because New Yorkers are people who know. We're people who create reality. You know, we know how to shape it, and that's tough. But just on a side note, everyone talks so much about the destruction. I used to spend 3 or 4 days a week at the World Trade Center involved with an educational corporation.
Okay.
Not having been there,
mm-hmm.
I've been very lucky in that I have beautiful, wonderful memories of hanging out on Liberty Street. And, you know, I've slept over in that building. I used to know all the security guards. And by not going to Ground Zero ever, I think I've tried to preserve, you know, the beauty of the memories I had of spending time. I mean, it was really an extraordinary time.
The memories there.
Without having to just only think of it now as this
rubble and a pit.
Yeah.
Kyla, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for your call. Lewis Gordon, here's Kyla with her active and warm memories where there is now, there was rubble and is now a kind of vacuum.
Indeed. In fact, one of the complicated aspects of this is the extent to which it is this ongoing absence that triggers a certain way of trying to maintain what Elias Canetti has called the lamenting pact. There's this sense that somehow there's a reflection on why is it, for a matter of chance, many people who are New Yorkers are connected to someone in New York. What made them survivors? Not only in the sense of those who were able to escape from the buildings, but just by chance, the fact that they were not in the city at that time. There's this strange collective guilt, this strange sense of responsibility for somehow not being there, and this affected a lot of the outpouring. But in addition to that, there is this complicated aspect of a geographical wound. When we talk about a wound, although wounds generally may heal, they do leave scars, and the hole there represents a memorial in the form of a scar. The additional point that we may consider in terms of New Yorkers is this complicated way in which this particular event is an organizing event. I think even in terms of the experience I had with the fact that I was in Providence and my wife, an avid Chicago nationalist, was actually on the island going through this complete period of mayhem. And it completely changed our understanding of her relationship to that city.
We're going to come back in a moment and talk more with Joel Meyerowitz about the photographs that he's taken of the whole arc of disaster and recovery in Lower Manhattan at the World Trade Center site. You can view some of the photos from Joel Meyerowitz's archive of Ground Zero. They're on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. We're talking about living through, living with, living after Ground Zero. What was, what is the symbolism of that pit in Lower Manhattan, and where does the focus of national grief move now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Are at 7:42.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This morning was the official end of recovery and cleanup at the World Trade Center site, Ground Zero site in Lower Manhattan. Tonight we're talking about living through, living with, living after Ground Zero. How do we move on without forgetting? And what about the towers, the people in the towers? How do they live in your mind? Has the New York skyline in your mind adapted to the change? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Joel Meyerowitz, the photographer who has been there from the early days right through, making an archive of everything so that history will not forget what happened there. Joel Meyerowitz, give us some of the images out of all those months of shooting that still goes on, but what are some of the images that most stick with you?
Well, talking about recent ones really is most appropriate. About 10 days ago, I was down there, and I saw two men walking over to that last stick, and they had just begun within that week to put names and some photographs on the last column. And it was an older and younger man, and the younger man tried to get a toehold up on the stick, and he couldn't quite get himself up far enough to put this picture he had in his hand. And the older man turned around and knelt down underneath him, and then with his hands on his knees, mm-hmm. he started to push, and he pushed this younger man up, 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 until he had him up on his back, almost on his shoulders. And it was, I saw it from maybe 50 yards away, and I ran towards them because the image was so mythic. It was as if one was growing out of the other in a way. And the older man was just sitting, you know, kneeling there, or leaning back against this and supporting the young guy.
Bearing up the younger.
Bearing up the younger, right. And it was powerful and sorrowful. And when they came down, I was standing there, and I asked them, you know, who they were. And they were a father and son, firemen. And they had lost their brother, son, the other member of the family. Mm-hmm. And they said that, you know, they were lucky because they had found him.
Good
and
God.
I thought, you know, you say lucky, and upon that, the three of us were just in tears. We were holding on to each other. And I have, every single day since then, I have found these two men, Paul and Ralph Geidel, to go and be with them because they rake 7 days a week. They come down there. And, you know, the most humble sight in this pit. Mm. And it's, again, another mythic image is a man leaning on a rake, like a shepherd in a field. Mm-hmm. And every load that's laid down, they step right into it and they start raking away. And they pick up little bits of finger bones or hip bones or cranial bones. And the other day, one of them said to me, look at this. And he found a tiny scallop shell the size of your pinky nail. And he said, isn't it amazing that this fragile thing withstood that amount of destruction and compression?
There it is, out of almost 2 million tons of destruction, a little shell.
A scallop shell, and it was perfect. It was unbroken. So, you know, you find these absurdities down there, and yet you find also these mythic images of mankind harking back to its ancient gestures of raking and leaning and lifting and waiting. It's a kind of patience that's just transformative.
Joel, let me invite Kimberly in. Kimberly's on the line. Welcome, Kimberly. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I wasn't in the World Trade Tower that day. My office was on the 92nd floor, but I managed a division that we lost a significant number of people that day.
Yes.
So I have, I think, honestly, people have kind of, they've moved, the site has, being cleared is, I don't think the scars that people have not really moved on. And I know that people, in many ways, think that New Yorkers have moved on, but if you were really personally impacted, I don't think, you know, truly people have moved that from that time.
Yeah, Kimberly, thanks for the observation. Joel, you photographed men mainly who were staring at it every day. Have they managed to move through it, to move on?
I think there's a sense of both relief and nostalgia. That's what I sensed over this last couple of months. There was a nostalgia for that early part when it was so horrific and everybody was doing things with such spirit and commitment and trying to save and find. And I think that they feel a kind of emptiness in their lives right now. And that period meant a lot to people. So it's a twist. It's a strange twist to feel this, a weariness and a gratitude that it's over, and yet a wistfulness towards the past.
It is strange when that past is so horrible. David's on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine.
Yeah, I think actually, in a way, you might have answered my questions, because I wanted to ask Joel. He's such a special photographer, I think, because his pictures just seem to capture the essence of things. And I was going to ask him, whether there's one photograph in particular that he thinks really represents, that he's taken, that really represents you know, something about what has happened, whether it's a photograph of sorrow or a photograph of hope or a photograph of courage.
Yeah, we understand the question, and Joel just gave us a good one, but let's ask for another. And thank you, David, for the call. Joel, tell us, paint another picture for us.
There was a photograph I made that was a brilliant, sunny day. And I think it's the day, the kind of day you say it's good to be alive. You know, you feel the sun on your back and the sky is blue and life feels good. And down there, a day like that is in contrast to the pile itself and the deaths of all those people. And yet the two of them, these two elemental things, you know, death and the property of ongoing life, are joined. And one has to face that in some way. And I found that a few times that I witnessed that, it was encouraging to me because it showed that time and nature will move us along. It's inevitable. And it was a reminder that that's the kind of hope. That's how hope is formed, in a way, by nature's indifference.
Joel Meyerowitz, as I understand, some of your photos will be going to Venice, to an exhibition there. Is that right, or what exhibition is that?
The Venice Biennale alternates each year between an art biennale and the architecture biennale. And this year, the U.S. Pavilion is going to show my work.
Only your work?
No, it will have, I was just going to say, in part of the pavilion there will be a number of architectural responses to the possible, site development.
But the whole display will be related to the World Trade Center and 9/11.
Yeah, well, the U.S. Pavilion's response.
Yeah.
The rest of the Venice Biennale is about next, what comes next, and it's actually in response to the effect of the World Trade Center. So like, what role should architecture play in general? What kinds of architecture is there possible in the world today, and what will happen at the World Trade Center?
But it does raise this question. How do we feel abroad and even at home with a pit being our national symbol or icon at the moment? Is there something necessary but also odd about it, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at that pit from any angle, from ground level or from above, it's a grave. Now it's more like a grave than it ever was before. And, that open, waiting, mournful place is it represents where we stand right now. It's true.
Joel Meyerowitz, I want to thank you for your work over all these months there, and I want to thank you for joining us again tonight.
Thanks, Tom. It's really nice to come back again.
Thanks for being with us, Joel. Take care.
Okay.
Joel Meyerowitz is internationally known photographer and filmmaker. He's been creating and continues to create a photographic archive of the World Trade Center disaster. And response, Lewis Gordon, it is an image that obviously is going to be powerful. There's going to be a lot of images that are powerful for a long, long time, but it's still hard to sort out exactly what their resonance will be over time.
Indeed. I kept thinking about Joel's remarks about the mythic quality of it, and as I thought about it, I thought about the Orphic myth. You know, Orpheus descends ultimately to resurrect Eurydice, and many of those workers descended in the hope that somebody would be alive. And now, later, they're ascending. But as they ascend, you know, I think the myth really comes around in a poignant way. When Orpheus emerged, he was ripped apart. In many ways, who they were when they descended is not who they are as they have now ascended. And it means that there's a great deal of them in that very process that was destroyed as something new is born.
Mm. There, locally on the site, with the men and women who took the cleanup into their own hands, and nationally, as we have looked on, it is an image and a memory that will never go away. Lewis Gordon, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. In a moment, one rescue worker looks back on 9 months at Ground Zero. This is On Point. Frank Shalecha has spent the last 9 months working as a rescue operator at the World Trade Center site, moving wreckage, guiding machinery, and searching for the remains of victims. After months of long days and seven-day work weeks, he's tired and he's proud of the work he's done. In this radio diary, he looks back at the site and the accomplishments of all those who toiled there.
We had the ceremony today, and it ended our diligence of trying to recover those that we lost. I did my job. I brought the people home, as many as we could find. It's done. We did the job that nobody thought we could do. We brought unity to everybody, and that's how we basically prevailed in our emotions to get this job done. We've been working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Some of us has lost touch with our families. We'd love to get back. Some of us look forward to our next job. You know, we're the industry. We build America. We've assisted in every way, shape, size, and form. And we honored the military when they came down, and they brought some joy to us, giving us thanks for our work, and us giving thanks to them for their support in foreign countries. We've all looked forward to bringing some comfort to families that have lost loved ones. And in our diligence of working around the clock till today, it's been quite gruesome and quite tiresome. It was a challenge that we faced, and we faced it together as America, and we did the job. It's been a team effort through this whole country to come to the aid of us that have been working down at Ground Zero. It's like having a kid come up to you and shake your hand because they're proud of you. And then you find out this little kid, his father perished as a fireman. Do you know how that makes a human emotion just beckon compassion? I am a father, and my children do miss me. My children are extremely proud. This is my last hurrah. I did hurt myself working down there. I'm going to retire. I started off as a rescue operator, and now I'm finished.
Frank Shalecha spent the last nearly 9 months working as a rescue operator at the World Trade Center site. To view a photo gallery of today's ceremony at Ground Zero, check out our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.